Now, one of the things that we're told in the Bible is that we better have an answer for those who ask us questions. And one of the big controversies that has raged among Catholics and Protestants, both for that matter, over the years has been the matter of God's law. Now, I'm going to give this sermon today and then follow it up with a more detailed one next Sabbath, God willing, if I live that long. And that makes my wife cringe every time I say that. But anyway, I'll get bawled out when we get home. Anyway, I'll give a more detailed one next Sabbath on the matter of justification and grace and law-keeping. But this one, I want to emphasize one thing. First of all, what is the purpose of the law? Why did God ever give us a law in the first place? Well, let's notice something here. Romans 7, verses 1 and 2. And this is a very good text here. And lays it out, I think, quite well. Not verses 1 and 2, but Romans 7, verses 12, 7 through 12. Here's what Paul said. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Now, I was looking at some of the websites about the law of God, and some of these things that these people said, well, you'd have to shake your head how people can be so stupid. They've been referred to, and we're talking about the Ten Commandments, they've been referred to as the terrible ten. Now, can you imagine that? The only person who would say somebody like that is a God-hater and someone who cannot stand to be told what to do. So he says, is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law. So what is the law? What's the purpose of the law? It defines sin. And remember, as we read in 1 John 3, 4, sin is the transgression of the law. It's not what various churches have come up with, the idea that they think sin is. It's very clear in the Bible it's a violation of the Ten Commandments. For I would not have known covetousness except the law said, thou shalt not covet. And then skipping down to verse 12, he says, therefore, the law is holy, the commandment holy and just and good. So the purpose of it is to reveal sin, to define what sin is, with the idea in mind that it can help us to direct our lives in a godly manner and receive the benefits and blessings that God intended from it. Now, there's a very, very good psalm here. I have a great deal of admiration for this psalm here because here's what it says. This is in verse number 7. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. Now, do you know of any man-made law that can convert the soul? You know, most man-made laws originally were based on Bible principles. You don't find that so much anymore because now you have laws touting homosexuality and same-sex marriages. And where are we going today now? It's just unbelievable what's taking place. Now, where can you find a law that's perfect that has no loopholes? You're not going to find any man-made law because I'll guarantee you, just as soon as man-made law is made, the lawyers get to work and then figure out a way around it. So I want to emphasize one thing in verse number 11 here. It talks about these various aspects of God's law, and then it says here, and this is really a key verse here, moreover, by them your servant is warned, and in the keeping of them, there is great reward. So there are real benefits that accrue to you if you are a law keeper, that is specifically God's commandments. And in addition to that, you're certainly told in the Bible you're to respect the laws of the land too. They go hand in hand. As long as those laws do not try to force you to disobey God. And there are man-made laws that have done that too. And it looks to me like it's gradually shaping in that direction here in this country too. But notice here in Romans 3, verse number 20, Therefore, and I'm going to be getting into this probably next Sabbath, therefore, by the deeds of the law, no flesh shall be justified in his sight. And then here's the key. For by the law is the knowledge of sin. Now, that leads us to the second thing. And I'm going to emphasize primarily the Gospels today, because this is what I want to deal with. I want to deal with what did Christ teach about the law, and what did he say? Now, let's go back to Deuteronomy 18 and notice something here. And then we'll go to Hebrews 12, because the two mesh together. And in Deuteronomy 18, in verse number 18, we read, I will raise up for them a prophet like unto you from among your brethren. This is what the Lord said. The Lord said to me, that is to Moses, I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brethren, and will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And it shall be that whoever will not hear my words. Oh, isn't that interesting? Here, this prophet is going to be speaking God's words, capital My. So this is clearly a reference to Christ. My words, which he shall speak in my name, I will require it of him. He's going to speak by the authority of God, and Christ being God certainly emphasizes that. Now, going back to Hebrews, the 12th chapter, notice what we read here in verses 24 and 25. To Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. In other words, we have a new dispensation entering in here. See that you do not refuse him who speaks. So we're going to see what Christ said about the law when he spoke. For if they did not escape who refused him who spoke on earth, much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him who speaks from heaven. So this is clearly a reference to Christ. Now, we know that he introduced the new covenant. But what was the purpose of this introduction that he brought forth? Well, there's a number of purposes. I want to emphasize this, however, in respect to the law. And here's what we read in Isaiah 42 and verse number 21. Keep in mind now, as I said earlier, if you know these things, you'll be in a position to answer people who may be questioning you at some time in the future. But in Isaiah 42 and verse number 21, the Lord is well pleased for his righteousness' sake. He will exalt the law and make it honorable or glorious. He will make it glorious. Now, the Old Testament law, we know very plainly, was a law of strictly letter of the law. They were not held accountable to the intent of the heart or what they thought. And when he was magnifying the law, what does the King James say? I think it says magnify the law and make it holy. Is that what it says in the King James? Something like that anyway. But in other words, he was going to put it on a much higher level and a higher plane than what it had been as far as the Jewish community was concerned. And notice what he himself said specifically. I don't know why it is that everybody who calls himself a Christian, whether he's a Catholic or a Protestant or whatsoever, just completely ignores these words. Why? Because they look at all the, somehow they got this notion in their mind that all the truth about the law of God is found in the writings of the Apostle Paul. They couldn't be more deceived. You do not interpret what Christ said or the prophets or anybody else said by Paul. It should be just exactly the opposite. Because as Peter said, Paul is hard to understand, and people who are clumsily use the word, I'm paraphrasing it, cannot understand him. He's difficult to understand. Yet they turn around and they say, Paul is the one that freed us from the Jewish yoke. Now we don't have to obey the commandments of God and the law anymore. They ignore what Christ said. Now, here's what Christ said. Listen carefully. Who are you going to believe, Christ or people who don't know how to understand Paul? Christ said, Matthew 5, verse 17, do not think I have come to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to make full. to fill it up. That's the literal Greek. Why do we say that? Because it's from the same word, sumpleru, that is found where Christ was in the boat with his disciples, and it said the boat was filled with water and began to sink. So it's to fill it up, to glorify it to a spiritual level. That's why he came. That's why the law, purpose of the law. For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will no means pass away from the law till all comes into being. This notion here that all is fulfilled is a very, very poor translation. And I firmly believe that many, many of the translators, and this goes back even to Wycliffe and to Tyndale, both of them, I'm not saying they did it deliberately, they may have been deceived, but many of these translations you find in the Authorized Version were based on what people already thought it should mean. Wycliffe, oh, I think Tyndale is very bad on this text here. He adds words that aren't even found in the thing. But here's what it should say. This is a second aorist subjunctive. So it can't be used in the past tense. It's not a past tense. Can't be used as that. And the best translation, you can look in any lexicon. I looked in one this morning, and this was the definition that was the clearest. It shall no means pass from the law until all comes into being. That's a literal meaning. In other words, you're going to see the full fruition of God's law as it applies to the whole universe. And in our particular case, particularly to man. And Jesus himself said, remember in John 15? He said, you are my friends if you keep my commandments. How many people out there call themselves Christians, regard themselves as the friends of Jesus, and don't keep his commandments? Here was Chrysostom in the 3rd century who said, we keep all the commandments, but the 4th one's done away. Where's the 4th one ever done away? If there are ever a flimsy ground for supporting Sunday, you're not going to, well, whoever comes up with it in the Bible doesn't even understand what the Bible says. There's absolutely no authority whatsoever for Sunday worship. Now, let's look through the various commandments and let's see what Jesus said. We have the first and second commandments. Now, those first and second commandments tell us what? To have no other gods before me and don't make any idols and fall down and worship them. All right, what did Jesus say here? First of all, to Satan, Matthew 4, verse number 10. When he said, notice what Satan said. All these things will I will give you if you will fall down and worship me. And Jesus said to him, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Now, did Jesus teach obedience to the first and second commandments? You bet he did. Notice what we read in Matthew 6, verse number 24. No man can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. That is the physical fruits and labor and money and all the things that the world things brings you. You cannot serve the two of them. If you make one of them ahead of God, you have an idol. So that's very clear what Jesus taught about that. Now I'm just going to touch on a couple of New Testament passages. We'll get to these probably later next week, but I just want to call your attention to this, because this was not only what Christ taught, but this is also what Paul taught. And 1 Thessalonians 1 and verse number 9, here's what Paul said. For they themselves declare concerning us, he's talking about these Thessalonians, what manner of entry we had to you, and how you turned to God from idols to serve the living and true God. So you find it very clearly the Bible emphasizes and Christ emphasized the first two commandments. Now, how about the third commandment? You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. That is, you're not to use it for any vain purpose. And specifically, as it was applied in the Old Testament, it meant taking an oath and using God's name in a deceitful manner and therefore misusing it. Now, today we have it used in every other derogatory manner in the form of profanity, and you name it, it's almost endless. But here we find in Matthew 5, verse number 33, again, you have heard that it was said of those of old, you shall not swear falsely. And when you took an oath like that, it involved God's name. But shall perform your oath to the Lord. But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven nor by earth, for it is God's throne. Neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool. Nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no. For whatsoever is more than these is from the evil one. That's pretty strong, isn't it? You go into a court of law, and they will ask you to raise your hand and swear on the Bible, I'll tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. You don't have to do that. You just have to affirm. I was called as a witness to a trial one time in Tennessee, and the lawyer told the bailiff that a number of us would not swear. We would only affirm. So before the trial started, the bailiff had everybody stand up, and he went through this rigmarole. Do you swear or affirm such and such? And we just said, we affirm. And that was acceptable to him. We didn't have to swear. And I remember when this, whichever hurricane it was down there in Florida, a few years ago, you know, they nail up all the windows with big boards. And this guy had his big storefront all nailed up with boards, and he had a big sign on it, not by the hair of my chinny chin chin. So he wasn't going to let his house blown in, you know, that huff and puff and blow your house in, not by the hair of my chinny chin chin, which is almost a form of swearing. Now let's notice here Matthew 23, verses 16 through 22. This is a little more specific here. Matthew 23, verses 16 through 22. Woe to you, he's talking to these Pharisees, scribes and Pharisees, who say, whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he's obliged to perform it. So you can see where their hearts were. Whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gift of the altar that is on it, he's obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things. And he who swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God who sits on it. So he was condemning them for doing these things, and it was an exact misuse of the third violation of the third commandment, not to misuse God's name. And this is what they were doing. That's why he said, don't swear at all. Now, what about the fourth commandment? This is the one that was rejected at a very early date, and it still is rejected because Martin Luther's so-called Reformation was not really a reform. It was a reformation from Catholic liturgy and Catholic ritual, and that's about all it was, because doctrinally it's the same thing. And Martin Luther, well, had a real problem. I'll probably mention this next week, but he got into a real jam over the book of James. There's one or two others. Those later books he also rejected. But he said, why? Because James said, unless you keep the law, you have no faith, because faith without works is dead. And Martin Luther concluded, well, the book of James is not inspired. That's how he got around it. Now you have thousands and thousands, even millions of people today who call themselves Lutheran, who believe Martin Luther. Now who are you going to believe, Martin Luther or the Apostle James? That's how they get around it. Now, the Catholics, of course, they rejected the Sabbath many, many years, probably within the certainly the second beginning, the second and the third centuries. That was already, in fact, we know there's historical evidence that the churches in Asia Minor kept the holy, had kept the holy days and the Sabbath clear up until the third century. And then you remember the Edict of Constantine and the Council of Nicaea that rejected Judaism and said anybody who now henceforth keeps the Sabbath will be regarded as anathema. That's how they did away with it. Well, let's notice what Christ said. Here this thing came up about the accusations he was making because these Pharisees and their self-righteous prig-moorish attitude decided that he wasn't keeping the Sabbath properly to suit them. And here's what he told them. You can read the context before it, and then you'll see exactly what took place here. But here's what he said. Verse 27. The Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. So they had turned it into a slavish devotion that was contrary to the intent that God had in mind. Therefore, the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. He's also the Lord of the Sabbath. So what's the Lord's Day? Sunday? The Lord's Day is the Sabbath. That's the day he set aside. And that's the day on which he tells us to worship. Now, let's ask this question. Did Jesus himself keep the Sabbath? Well, let's notice Mark chapter 1 and verse number 21. Then they went to Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and taught. So here he was. What was he doing in the synagogue on the Sabbath if he wasn't keeping the Sabbath? Now you can notice another text here in Mark 6 and verse number 2. Mark 6 and verse number 2. He went from there and came to his own country, and his disciples followed him. And when the Sabbath had come, he began to teach in the synagogue. So there he was. Now you can even find, there are more texts. I'm just giving a few examples here so you have something to look at. If you wanted to get out more detail, all you'd have to do is get a concordance and look up Sabbath and see all those places where Jesus was observing it. But here in Mark, Luke 4, verse number 16, so he came to Nazareth where he had been brought up, and as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. So there he was, keeping the Sabbath, wasn't he? Now the idea is that Paul was the one that did away with the Sabbath. Or he freed us from the Jewish yoke. Well, I want to point out something here because this is another example, I believe, that the King James translators and others were fundamentally dishonest in a translation because they didn't want to accept it or they didn't believe it. You know, I was accused one time of changing the meaning of the scripture if I show you what the proper Greek word is, which shows you that people who make that remark have no understanding whatsoever of translations in Greek texts. Now, in Hebrews 4, here's what Paul says. Let's pick it up here. He said, therefore, since the promise remains of entering into his rest, and let's pick it up here in verse 18 of the previous verse. And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest? Now, the Holy Land is the rest they were entering into. They were crossing Jordan River and entering into that, the word meaning here, place of resting down. It's katapausis in the Greek, a place of resting down. And such a promise remains, he says then in chapter 1, of entering his rest. Let us fear, lest any of you seem to have come short of it. Now, he's not talking about these people going back into the Holy Land as a place of rest. He's talking about a spiritual level now. He elevates it. Because the rest, the Holy Land, was only a type of the spiritual rest in God's kingdom. For indeed was the gospel preached to us as well as to them, but the word which they heard did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in those who heard it. And we who have believed do enter into that rest. That is, those of us who are on the spiritual level now and really understand the whole significance and meaning of the new covenant and what Christ brought, we're candidates for entering into that rest. Same word, katapusis. So I swore my wrath. So here's what God said to those people. They shall not enter my rest. Katapusis, a place of resting down. Although the works were finished from the foundation of the world, even though they had all been set in motion and they were intended for that purpose, they were rejected. For he has spoken on a certain day of the seventh day in this way. And God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again in this place, they shall not enter my rest. Now we find a correlation here between the Sabbath, don't we? We don't find this in the scriptures. But this was an early teaching, and it was even carried down in Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire when he mentions the Christians, and he said it was believed that as man has a six 1,000-year days followed by a 1,000-year millennial rest, then man has 6,000 years to rule himself followed by the millennium of 1,000 years. It's certainly indicates that would be true, although it's not specifically said that in the scriptures. Therefore, it remains that some must enter it, that is, this spiritual rest, and those to whom it was first preached did not enter because of disobedience. They did not fulfill the type. Remember, that first generation, all over 20 years of age, perished in the wilderness. Not a one of them entered in, except two. Joshua and Caleb. And again, he designates a certain day, saying in David, today, after so long a time, as it has been said, today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, and if you should have a little footnote here, verse number 8, and it says, Jesus. And the word actually that is most rightly believed to refer to Jesus, the word that it was used in his time period was Jehoshua or Jehoshua. And we have the English translation of Jesus. But anyway, if he would not have given them rest, if he would have given them rest, in other words, if they had gotten rest under Joshua, he would not have again have spoken of another day. There remains, therefore, a rest for the people of God. Now, you see this word rest? It's not katapausis. It's sabbatismos, which means a keeping of the Sabbath. There remains a keeping of the Sabbath for the people of God. Now, you can't tell me that these translators didn't know this. They turned right around and translated rest because they didn't want to admit that the Sabbath is required. And this is what Paul is telling. So don't try to tell me that the Sabbath is not taught by Paul. Now let me give you some of Paul's examples here. Notice Acts 13, verses 42 and 43. Now when the Jews went out of the synagogue, the Gentiles begged that these words might be preached to them the next Sabbath. Now when the congregation had broken up, many of the Jews and devout proselytes followed Barnabas and Paul, who, speaking to them, persuaded them to continue in the grace of God. On the next Sabbath, almost the whole city came together to hear the word of God. Now what was Paul doing preaching on the Sabbath if he didn't keep the Sabbath and it was done away? Notice also Acts 17, verse number 2. There are the passages, but these are two of the outstanding ones. Now, when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, and there was a synagogue of the Jews. Then Paul, as his custom was, went into them, and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures. As his custom was, Paul kept the Sabbath. So there's ample proof that Jesus certainly supported and taught the obedience to the seventh-day Sabbath, not Sunday, the first day of the week. Now, what about the fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother? Well, let's go to Matthew 19, verse number 19. Matthew 19, verse number 19. Honor your father and your mother, and you shall love your neighbors yourself. Here Jesus said very plainly to honor your father and your mother. And then you can find an interesting statement here in Matthew 15, verses 5 and 6. Excuse me. Matthew 15, verses 5 and 6. Beginning in verse 4, God commanded, saying, here's Jesus talking, honor your father and your mother, and he who curses father and mother, let him be put to death. But I say to you, whoever says to your father and mother, whatsoever profit you might have received from me is a gift of God. In other words, what I could have given you, I gave to God. Then he need not honor his father and her mother. In other words, if he gives it to God, he has been freed from the obligation of supporting or helping his parents. You have made the commandment of no effect by your tradition. Hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy of you. So there's Jesus' candid statement here about the Pharisees, how they got around showing proper honor and respect for one's parents. And then I'm going to read one text here from Paul once again because it shows you what he stated. And this is in Ephesians chapter 6, verse number 2. Honor your father and your mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you, that you may live long on the earth. So here's what Paul taught. So we see very plainly that these things were taught. Now, let's look at the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. The literal Hebrew is, thou shalt do no murder. And we have some of these PETA people, that, I mean, I never saw a bunch of people so wacky thinking in their life. I was watching Blowhard Bill the other day, and he was talking to some PETA woman there, and she's against catching fish. Because she said, fish have feelings, and if you catch them, it hurts them. And Blowhard Bill was saying, well, Bloviating Bill, I guess I should say, he was saying that there's, what was some specialist who was a specialist in nerves in animals, and I've been told this before by other veterinarians, that they do not have a system that works both ways. In other words, when they get some strike somewhere, they don't have the feeling, so they can return and tell them that they're feeling pain. And I remember one time I was fishing with a friend of mine, and he brought up this bluegill, and he looked at it and said, "No," he said, "look at this stupid thing. Do you think this thing is now thinking I'm really hurting?" The fact is, if God made these creatures, as Peter said, to be taken and destroyed, dumb brutes taken and destroyed, do you think God would put in them the same nervous system and the same feelings that human beings have if God is a just and honorable God? Of course not. Anybody ought to be able to think that out. Do they have feeling of some kind? Sure they do. But is it the kind we have? And do they have the consciousness and ability to think things through like we do? Of course not. So here we read here, in Matthew 5, verses, Matthew 5, verse number 21, I should say. Matthew 5, verse number 21. You have heard that it was said of those of old, you shall not murder, which is correct. That's proper translation. And whosoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. Now, really, they did even have in the Old Testament period a provision for what we would call manslaughter today. That is, if you kill somebody accidentally. Today we have involuntary manslaughter, or we have voluntary manslaughter. And I'm not sure what term the involuntary manslaughter carries, but voluntary manslaughter usually carries a term of what, 5-10 years. Back in the Old Testament period, if you killed somebody accidentally, it simply showed you were careless, you did not have responsibility to be thinking about anybody but yourself, and so you were given the privilege to flee to a city of refuge. And if you were caught by any relative of that dead person, they could kill you legally and there would be no accountability held. You went to the city of refuge. You came before the judges, the Levites, and they judged the case. And if they saw very plainly it was an accident, then you were not slain, but you were confined to that city of refuge until the death of the high priest. And if you left that city of refuge at any time, you were subject to death. That's how careless people were removed from society so they wouldn't be a danger to anybody else. Now, how many times do we have these DUIs running all over the country, killing people, arrest after arrest after arrest, and this pussy-footing laws we have today? I mean, it's absolutely disgusting. You could have a safe society then. How safe is your society today? How many young people have just been killed by some worthless drunk? So here's what it says then. Whoever shall not murder, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. Now, does that sound like he did away with it? No, I'll tell you what he did. I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother lightly, that's what the Greek means, from some little insignificant, very, very meaningless reason, you're angry with your brother for that, without a cause, or lightly is what it should read here, he shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever says to his brother, Raca, and this was a term of the greatest contempt, and what it showed was a virtual hatred for somebody. Now let me say this. We should try very hard not to hate people. And with God's help, we can do that. But we don't have to like what they do. We can hate what they do. He shall be in danger of the council. But if you say, whoever says you fool shall be in danger of hell fire. That's the highest insult you can give somebody. Now, I have to say, there are some men on this earth who are utter fools. I'll give you one good example, Christopher Hitchens. This guy is one of the top 100 intellectuals in the world, and he is an absolute God-hater, and I mean he's an atheist. And they had him on CNBC, and Anderson Cooper asked him what he thought about Jerry Falwell, and I was just shocked at his answer. I mean, he just became vitriolic. He said, I hope he's rotting in hell. He had such hatred for him. You know, Jerry Falwell, he was deceived, of course, but he was certainly well-meaning, and you can't say that everything he did was bad. You can just be thankful God is the one that does the judging. Now, does the Bible say somebody who is an atheist and doesn't believe in God, who rejects God, is a fool? Absolutely. Read Psalm 14. So there are people who are fools. But this, you see, has to do with whether somebody is, you're upset about something that's very light, insignificant. So it shows you that here, this sixth commandment about not only murdering, but having an attitude of murder and hatred in your heart's the same thing. And that's exactly what John says here in 1 John chapter 3. 1 John 3 and verse 15. Whoever hates his brother is a murderer. Very plain, isn't it? Why? Because you're being judged by the intent of the heart. And you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. What he's saying is, if you hate somebody, you're not going to make it into God's kingdom, plain and simple. But you can certainly hate the things they do. Now, what about the seventh commandment? Here you read in Matthew chapter 5 and verse number 27, "You have heard that it was said of those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, whosoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in her heart," in his heart. In other words, what he's done, he's looked at her and he's had this longing feeling and he just continues to think about it. Now, I don't know, some of you guys have been in the military. You know what it's like. These guys in the military, they got their minds on two things, food and sex. I was with a guy one time, and every time he saw a woman, he'd say, "Whoo, did you see her look at me? Oh, man, she's looking at me." And he had a mug that only a mother could love. And I was with another guy one time, and every single woman, he'd make a comment about her breasts. He had a breast fixation. So this is what people have their minds on now. Is that a violation of the law of adultery? Sure it is. Did Jesus do away with it? He certainly didn't. And let's notice here Romans 7 verses, well, let's go to Hebrews 13 verse 4. Hebrews 13 verse number 4. "Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers God will judge." So here's Paul making it very plain. So it shows you very plainly that this is another one of God's commandments that is certainly upheld by Christ. Now let us take a look at the eighth commandment. "Thou shalt not steal." And we read in Matthew 19. Matthew 19. Let me get back to it here. What I'm emphasizing today is so you'll understand it thoroughly. I'm telling you what Christ taught, what Christ himself said. And we read in the scriptures, he's the one you'd better hear. And you better not hear these people who talk about Paul doing away with everything. Because Paul did not. And we'll get a better explanation of that next week. But let's notice here in Matthew 19, verse number 17. "Why do you call me good? No one is good but one, that is God. But if you want to enter into life, keep the commandments." And he said, which? The one I'm going to emphasize here is, you shall not steal. Yeah, I believe that's correct. I'm going to mix up here between the eighth and the ninth here. Let me get back here to Exodus 20 here and be sure I'm correct here. Exodus 20. This is where you find one list of the Ten Commandments. Yeah, you shall not steal. That's the eighth. And then the ninth is you shall not bear false witness. And then the tenth is not covet. So we're talking about stealing here. Now, let me ask you this. Did Jesus teach not to steal? Sure he did. Now, there are myriad and myriad of ways to steal, especially in the technological age in which we live today, and identity theft is one of them. That's why you have to be very careful on your computer, and this is why what I do is I take any kind of a bill or anything I've got that's got either a Social Security card number or anything that has to do with a bank account number, and I run it through the shredder. Because what these people will do, they'll go through your trash cans. They'll go through the garbage, because once you put the garbage out in the street, it's no longer yours, legally. So you want to be careful about that. And You want to be careful how you use the internet and where you let names, let numbers and names let out. But that's just one form of theft. There's all kinds of. They caught a ring here. I think there were three or four of them living over in Springfield, and I forget how many mailboxes they had opened and taken the people's mail out, and got their card, their checks, and then they washed the checks. What they do is that they take the check and they put it under some solution, but to keep the signature out of that solution, and it erases all the writing on the check. Then they just turn around and rewrite it for whatever sum they want, and it's taken out of the person's bank account. They make the check out to them, and then they collect. That's stealing, isn't it? Did Christ uphold the law about stealing? Absolutely. And then let us notice here Ephesians 4:20. I just want to read this one text by Paul here. Ephesians 4, verse number 28. Let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give him who has need. So again, you see, the Bible, certainly a New Testament, Christ certainly upheld that. Now let's look at the ninth commandment. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Matthew 15, verse number 19. They accuse Christ, you see, of not washing their hands when they ate. And then he explained to them, it's not what enters into your stomach that defiles you. He's talking about spiritually, what comes out of your heart and mind that defiles you in God's eyes. And that's if you just let your human nature and your lust just run away and you think and do whatever you want. The Bible calls them sons of Belial, meaning without a yoke. So you find here, out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness. Did Jesus condemn lying and somebody that's a false witness? You bet he does. And in Mark 10, verse number 19. Mark 10, verse 19. Well, we have the same thing here. Why do you call me good? And then he says here in verse number 19, do not bear false witness. So you want to tell the truth. You have people get up in the court of law and he'll say, do you swear the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? And they say, do, and then they turn around and lie like a rug. There are people who couldn't tell the truth if their very lives depended on it. And I knew one man that was in this church one time that said he didn't know why he always lied, because the truth would serve him better. Well, you get in the habit of that very early in life, and it's got to be broken. So the Bible does not support somebody who gets the notion that it's all right to fib a little bit. Is there such a thing as a white lie? No, there isn't. And in Colossians 3, verse number 9, again, just want to read what Paul said here. Colossians 3, verse number 9. Do not lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds. So you want to remember that. Now, what about the 10th commandment? Shall not covet. And that means when you come to the place where you have an inordinate desire that's so strong, that's all you're thinking about. That's all you desire. That's all you wish. And somebody who's covetous is not a happy person. Now, let's notice here Luke 12. Luke 12, verse number 13. Then one of the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take heed and beware of covetousness. For one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses." And then he went on right after this to explain. He gave the example of this rich man. And he didn't have any room for his bumper crops. And so instead of helping needy people with his abundance, what did he do? He said, "Well, I have many goods for many years. I'll eat, drink." He said, I'll make more room. I'll build more barns. I'll make more room. Then I'll eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "Fool, this night your soul shall be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." See, it's a matter of priorities. And coveting is a major problem for a lot of people in this world today. Romans 13, verses 9 and 10. Romans 13, verses 9 and 10. And you'll find a summary here of what Paul said. And he certainly did not do away with the commandments of God, contrary to what people think he said. Romans 13, verse 9. Paul says, "If you love one another, he's fulfilled the law." And then he gives a summary here of all these other things. And then he says here, "You shall not covet." Verse 9. "You shall not covet." So you see, you have all these admonitions that are found in the scriptures and all these examples of what Christ himself taught. Did he teach obedience to the law of God? Then why don't they hear Christ? Instead, they hear everybody but Christ. And if you're going to call yourself a Christian, you better follow him, because here, that's what his advice is. And I'll tell you what he said here. And as I bring this to a sermon to close to Matthew chapter 7, verse number 24. "Therefore, whoever hears these things of mine and does them, I will liken to a wise man who built his house on the rock, and the rain descended, and the floods came, and the wind blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on a rock. But everyone who hears these things of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand, and the rains descended, and the floods came and blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall." So there you go, brethren. If you're supposed to be able to answer those who ask you, then you can certainly show very plainly from the scriptures that Jesus Christ taught obedience to the law of God in every respect. Now, next Sabbath, we'll address this thing of Paul and make this clear.